This episode of East Meets West is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account, go to Squarespace.com and use the code EAST. Welcome to East Meets West, episode 205. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Chang.
And it is good to be back after the first scheduled East Meets West without both of us. We have had this happen one time before where Randy Jordan was a guest, and then I got sick at the last minute. Randy sort of filled in as co-host, and we still thank him for that. But last week you had Aileen Gaspar and Scott Johnson on as your official co-hosts with me.
They were great. They were awesome to have on. It's fun.
It was a great episode, but it also made me feel useless because it was so good that I was like, I don't know if I need to be around anymore.
I'm not going to argue with you, Tom.
I knew you would. That was a very Ed McMahon laugh.
You know, I went to his house one time before he had the whole issue with the mold and mildew.
That's right. You and Ed are old friends.
I think,
rest in peace Ed McMahon,
at the time he had a pretty swank house and on a chunk of the Santa Monica up there in the Santa Monica Hills. Really nice guy. I think he was 81 and that was 2003 and he was still sharp as a tack, which goes to show that as long as you keep yourself busy and your brain functioning, I think most people can stave off the supposed mental issues that creep up with age.
He was one of those guys like Dean Martin that had a reputation for drinking, but then lived well into his 80s. Dean Martin also lived well into his 80s. And I think they both had a reputation for drinking that well exceeded the amount of drinking they did. Because I remember, I think I've probably mentioned this before, but on the day Dean Martin died, it was around Christmas. I can't remember if it was Christmas Day or the day after Christmas. I came flying back into Austin from being with my family. I went straight to the hole-in-the-wall bar from the airplane. Was hanging out with some friends and they're like, hey, did you hear Dean Martin died? You know, of course he did, the way he drank. And I'm like, dude, the guy was like 81. He was in his 80s. He didn't die from drinking. He died from being old.
And, you know, the thing is, you know, what I know from Ed McMahon's life is that he would take like a sabbatical like every year or so, where he would rejuvenate himself, he'd go to a spa, he'd go for like this full body conditioning. So I don't think it was like hard drinker, hard smoker, and like eat lots of fried food. The way he talked to me about his lifestyle, it seemed to be a very healthy, a very proactive kind of approach to living. So he might have gone to events where he, you know, put a couple of dozen back, but it's not like he, you know, wakes up in the morning with a bottle of scotch, you know, rinses his mouth with it, and then like sits down to a breakfast of, you know, bacon, eggs, and French toast every day.
Well, yeah, you don't, if you're drinking any decent kind of scotch, you don't rinse your mouth with it. That'd be a waste. But I think, well, who knows? I don't know enough about Ed McMahon's life to say. Maybe he went through a period where, you know, he had troubles with alcohol, and that's why he was so healthy later on. I mean, that is
it. It could very well be. I mean, it, especially in that, you know, that era where he was, you know, starting and working through his career. I mean, that was kind of what you did, you know, after the shoot, you went out with the boys and you went to the bar and you had dinner, but you drank a lot, you partied and, you know, stumbled home.
There were a lot of guys. Dean Martin was one of them, for sure. I do know a little bit more about him. Walter Cronkite was another one where they could appear to drink a lot, because they always had a drink in their hand, but they actually didn't drink a lot. They were very good at just, you know, having one or two, and then leaving
like
it
me,
at that.
Like having the one I start off with.
You can have half, I think, and then you're done. Sorry, from what I know. I saw a Twitter picture this at the end of last week. You were at some swanky restaurant drinking a cocktail that looked huge.
No, that was the camera. It wasn't that huge. It was in a martini glass and,
Did you drink the whole thing though? Because I worried about that.
Well, it wasn't a martini. It was actually like just strawberry Grand Marnier and rum, like good rum. And it was fine. I mean,
Right.
I think the biggest effect was the fact that it was so late that we were having dinner. It was like 10 o'clock, 10:30. So mm-hmm. we were all tired and we're all kind of like, you know, and one of the guests had just flown in from Israel. So he was like, what's the time zone there? 6-7 hours behind.
Sure. Yeah.
So he was totally out of it. And he was like nodding off. And it wasn't because we're all like, you know, lushed up or anything. It was just, we were tired.
So you went to this fancy restaurant that had like silver plates, and
it had a silver platter. So this place is called Tommy Toy, and that's the guy's name, the proprietor who started the restaurant. It's a very swank, kind of upscale Chinese, and I put Chinese in quotes because it's not a traditional Chinese sit down family style where everyone, you know, you order and you get these big plates and you serve yourself off a lazy Susan. It was more a 4-course meal that you ordered. And you essentially, you know, would get these set items individually for each plate. Now, the silver platter they had in front of me was merely decorative.
I thought we were
going to eat off them. And I was like, holy crap, this is what Macbeth's head was served up on. And I was like, this is going to be cool. And then they took it away. It's like, aw. So, and then they just put down these large traditional plates with a fork and spoon and knife. It was very much Asian themed if you did it back in the 60s, kind of, which is really popular in San Francisco. A lot of the tiki bars and a lot of the Asian Pacific Island themed food places were done up all around the city, and it kind of has that feel, even though I think it was started in the mid to late 70s.
The pitcher in the chat room called it that fake plate that they have is called a charger. I don't know why it's called a charger, but yeah, that's quite common in the fancier restaurants to have a decorative plate like that so that the place setting looks nice when you sit down at the table, but then they don't want you eating off of that. So they take the charger away and they,
so is that like a Elvis Presley commemorative plate that they put in front of you when you sit down?
And yeah. You know, I think they're supplied by the same company. What is that? What are the Franklin Mint?
I don't want to appear too ignorant, but I've always been curious about
possible.
Yes. Always curious about the origins of the decorative plates. You know, they have the Elvis, the commemorative set. And I know that a lot of Dutch because my parents bought a restaurant from a Dutchman, there were a lot of Dutch plates that had that, but they weren't as colorful and they didn't, you know, have Elvis's head. They had traditional, you know, pictures
How you've just stereotyped the entire Dutch as plate loving maniacs because the guy that your parents happened to buy their restaurant from had a bunch of plates.
He was explaining to me that was a Dutch thing. So who am I to argue with Jan?
Yeah, but you know, he thinks that's a Dutch thing because he thinks everyone in the world's like him. Probably most Dutch are like, I don't collect plates. What are you talking about? That's like saying all of them have their thumbs in dikes.
No, just you need a few. You don't need all of them.
Just need the one. Just need the one boy.
The one.
That's all you need. He saves the whole town.
But
I'm with you though. I want to know where this tradition of collective plates come from, and I could make up an explanation, but I don't actually know. And I would think that chargers would have something to do with that, right? Which I see how that could happen, which you're trying to make things ever more beautiful, especially in the era of royalty, right? Where you want the place settings to be amazing. So you come up with these wonderful plates, gilt with gold and platinum, that just look beautiful. But you also know that if you have people eat off those plates, they're not going to be beautiful anymore, for one thing. And second of all, they might actually poison the guests depending on what metals you use. So when you bring the food out, you swap them out. You take out the beautiful plates and you put the food in. And then the food is the decoration, right? So the plate doesn't have to be quite as decorative at that point. But then how do you get from there to the Elvis Presley plate? I don't know.
Maybe it was over the years, people like, you know, well, you know, that looks kind of cool. Maybe I want something like that, but I want it more contemporary. I don't want like, you know, a medieval or Shakespearean style, you know, set top. I want Elvis Presley. I want, you know, whatever presidents or Star Trek. They make Star Trek commemorative plates. So I want Star Trek. It goes along with my Star Trek chess set made of fine pewter. My Star Trek, you know, phone, my Star Trek phone.
The picture in the chat room says it's more common to put the dinner plate on the charger. so that it stays there. That makes more sense. Although I've been at restaurants where they just take it away.
It just took it away. I think the plates they used were too wide to actually fit in without it teetering off. So Tom and Roger, we should do the Antiques Roadshow. Thank you very much, Conrad. We should go through and BS everyone. Well, yeah, this cabinet was made in the 1785. And then just give them like a bunch of crap about it. And then just say it's worth millions. They go away happy. And you know what? They'll never sell it because they think they have something worth tremendous amounts of money, but they don't want to give it away because it's a source of pride.
The antique scam show.
It's a win-win situation. They feel good about the rotting piece of wood in their corner, and we get exposure on PBS.
We just do the antique scam show. We'll get Brian Brushwood to help us out, and we just
that's a brilliant idea.
I like it.
Awesome. Turn of the century scams.
Actually, you know who would be really good at that? Who should absolutely do that is John Hodgman, because it's his whole industry is just making up things that are hilarious but non-factual, but somehow have a strange internal logic to them. He would be brilliant at that.
I would not disagree with you. What would you call it? The Hodgman Roadshow? Hodgman Knows Best? I like Hodgman Knows Best. It kind of goes
with the
hook.
More information about your antiques than you require. No, this is a little bulky. Something in that areas of antiques of my expertise, actually, that could work.
The Hodgepodge. Blue Fox said the Hodgepodge. That's actually pretty good.
All right, well, we're making up good work for John Hodgman, at least, if nothing else.
All right, so you have not caught up on any TV shows because you were out for a week and a half.
I have caught up on a few, actually. I'm caught up American style on Doctor Who, but I'm not caught up UK style. So I have not gone and gotten pirated versions or in some other way, maybe through a proxy, been able to view Doctor Who. But I have watched all the ones that have aired here on BBC America. I'm behind on Stargate Universe, actually, a couple weeks. So I can't really speak to that.
I was recording them. Unfortunately, they only record in SD for me, so I don't get the HD version of it. And I was letting it sit, and then I finally watched them. It's really interesting. I don't want to spoil it too much, but they essentially do a thing with who's the not the doctor but the Brainiac that had all that trouble with the commander. What's his name?
You talking about the Scottish guy?
Yes.
Yeah.
Not the chubby kid. I don't know anyone's name on that show.
Rush.
Yes, Rush. Yeah. They do kind of a flashback memory thing where he has to work out his memories in order to help find the answer in the ancient device that controls the ship. And I thought that was kind of cool. But at the same time, parts of it felt kind of recycled from either previous SG-1 episodes it literally from the SG like universe. It felt like they borrowed a couple of
Is that the one with Michael Shanks?
Yes. Yeah. Did you see that
No, I haven't seen it yet. I saw the trailer for it, though.
So I was hoping for a better one. It wasn't disappointing, but I was hoping it'd be better because Michael Shanks was in it after he came back to the SG series after he tried to strike it on his own and found out no one cared.
Yeah. All right, let's take a quick break. Let you know that this episode is brought to you thanks to Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. If you haven't tried out Squarespace, you can do it for free. They've got an easy-to-use UI for creating and managing your website. You can do it as a total noob, total beginner, or if you're a CSX... I always say that. It's some kind of subtle advertising thing. Yes. CSS expert. If you're an expert in that stuff, you can go and customize that. So it's kind of built for all levels of expertise. They've got a lot of design templates you can use, or you can build your own. You can plug in things like Photo Gallery Forum, all that stuff, Google Maps. They've got an Ajax interface, so you can drag and drop some stuff. It's pretty nice. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com. You don't need a credit card. You can try it out absolutely free. You can import your old website, see how it looks, play around with it. If you decide to purchase the service, you get 10% off the life of your account when you enter the code EAST. That's EAST. And they just added a native Twitter widget that allows you to add multiple accounts, filter by keyword, and customize the look and feel of your design. So check it out, squarespace.com. Use the offer code EAST when you decide to purchase it. So getting back to television shows, though, the Doctor Who's that I have seen I haven't felt are as good as the premiere.
But what was the last one you saw? So it's
I
just
have
so
seen here. I have seen the open where he meets Amy Pond. I have seen the one where he takes her to the UK.
Oh, on the ship, the Beast Below. Okay.
Yeah, the Beast Below. That's the most recent one, right? And then
no, I think there's one after that one that was.
The one after that involves. What is the one after that? The Daleks. That's right. The one where they visit Winston Churchill, World War II. And they find Daleks there. I don't want to do too many spoilers for people who haven't seen it. So I liked the plots. I thought the writing was very strong. What I'm disappointed with is Matt Smith, who I remember talking about this. I felt like he was very strong at delivering the wording that David Tennant made very famous, but without sounding like he's imitating David Tennant. And I feel like his focus drifted in these two episodes. There's a couple times where he's got the patter going, but he seems to be elsewhere. He doesn't seem to be.
It feels like he's going through the motions. He's essentially going, you know, do this, do that, do this. I will say that the next two episodes that you haven't seen will be much better. And I think you begin to see a little of Matt Smith coming through. I think it'll be maybe another episode or two before he finally feels comfortable he gets in the zone where he can be the Doctor without necessarily imitating David Tennant. So yeah, I think you'll be pleased with the next two of that series.
So you're saying you saw what I was talking about where I don't know if he's phoning it in so much. I think that might be harsh.
I don't think he's phoning it in. I think he's playing it safe by
finding his way or something. Yeah.
If it's the Beast Below, I actually liked. I thought that was a very, very interesting.
That was a great story. I love the story.
I wasn't too keen on the Dalek one. I thought that was kind of hokey.
I liked it. If they're gonna drag the Daleks back, which I guess they have to. They, you know, it's just something you can't defeat the Daleks forever and eliminate them from the Who universe. It's just not going to happen. So that was a creative way of dragging it back. I didn't really love the multicolored
Power Rangers Daleks that roll out. I was expecting them to form a larger Dalek together.
Exactly.
That would have been awesome. And that would have been
some kind of shopping channel presentation. You can get the Daleks in these five bright colors now.
Literally, it was the Power Rangers Daleks. Because you have one of each primary color, and then actually one of and two additional ones, and then they would form together to form a larger robot / Dalek, and that would be the Super Dalek.
But I did like the Winston Churchill. I thought he did a good job as Winston Churchill, and I thought they did a great job of capturing that wartime spirit and all of that. And I'll tell you what I loved about that episode and The Beast Below is Amy Pond, who I was very nervous about.
You're very smitten by her.
Well, she is the most normal looking Doctor Who sidekick that we've had in this modern vision, right? You know, because Rose Tyler was very working class, and she had a unique sort of look to her, and then we had Freema Agyeman, we had Martha Jones, who's just fantastic, brilliant, smart, cool, my favorite actually of all of them, and then Donna Noble, who's not the classic at all, you know, very stocky and funny and hilarious. And so when I saw Amy Pond, and I was like, okay, she's Scottish. That's a little different, I guess. But she has turned out, they have written her a character that is brilliant and bordering on Martha Jones brilliant. In fact, I think she may be getting close to surpassing her. I like the way they have her come up with the solution that the Doctor overlooked because of
what's interesting with that is that for her, it's not, you know, a brainiac isn't because she's smarter than the Doctor. She just sees and notices things in a different light than he does. And therefore she clues in on, you know, a possible answer that doesn't involve her needing to know, you know, 4 years of graduate physics or understanding how space and time work, but rather how, you know, human nature or emotions or you know, how social interactions would normally, you know, have between different people or different species. So it's more of a down to earth kind of folksy wisdom I think, which is kind of cool, versus, you know, having all of the universe's information like inside your encyclopedic head kind of thing, which is the Doctor.
I think the other thing I like, which is unlike Rose Tyler, unlike Martha Jones, who got the closest, and unlike Donna Noble, she doesn't doubt herself. You don't have her, which you definitely had with Rose. Rose was always like, "Oh, I don't know, Doctor. You know, am I going to be able to do this? Am I going to be able to help you?" Martha Jones was more confident and more resistant to the Doctor on certain points, but in the end said, "No, I shouldn't be flying with you." And she was always in Rose's shadow a little bit, and a little tentative about being the sidekick, being the companion. And Donna, that her whole character was that she was this amazing person who was trying to overcome her own lack of self-confidence. Yeah. That was her character.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, someone brought up a good point. I think Christian does. In the next two episodes, you'll see her in a different light, because you'll see her more. See, I don't want to say anything because it might give away too much.
But less self-confident or more
less self-confident, a little more out of her depth. She feels, you know, you kind of get a feeling that she's a little more.
Well, great. That's the one thing I love about her, and now they're going to take that away.
Well, watch the two episodes and you come back to me, and we'll argue it. But I was curious, because you were in Hawaii. Did you watch any TV at all, like the local news or anything like that?
Not a bunch. We did turn it on one or two nights. We watched 30 Rock one night, and so we got a little bit of that. I was reading the West Hawaii News, which is the paper on the Kona side of the Big Island. Why do you ask?
No, I'm just curious to see what the how big of the story, because, you know, the recent oil spill in the Gulf, and its threatening of the Gulf Coast states. I'm curious to see, because, you know, one of the things I usually do to see how big a story is nationally, internationally, is I find the story on CNN, and then I'll go to, you know, five or six different foreign news sites to see at what stage that story is, whether it's on the front page or the front of the website, or it's buried in their international news or somewhere else. And it's pretty big news. So I'm just curious if it was or is big news over in Hawaii.
I don't know that I can give you a fair evaluation of that. I didn't watch the Hawaii evening news at all. I did pick up the West Hawaii paper, but the headlines in the West Hawaii paper were all Hawaiian news. They were Hawaiian state news, and the big stuff going on there was a ratification of gay marriage, the merger of the two Honolulu newspapers into one company. There were some other votes on tourism money being allocated to the counties, stuff like that. So I don't know that they ever put the big international stories, but I believe there was the day of the spill, it was on the front page, just not the banner headline. And I did hear about it. We did hear, you know, reports and people talking about it here and there. So I don't know if I can give you an accurate estimate of how well it was covered there, but even in my vacation haze, it permeated, and I picked up on it without having to go seek it out, without like picking up the BBC News or the New York Times websites and checking them out.
All right. Now, another thing you did in Hawaii, which you didn't do here, which without me, is go see Kick-Ass with Eileen. Now, I'm sure you were probably sick to death of me twittering it up like for the past week, 2 weeks. And I'm curious to know what your impression or your final review of that movie is.
I liked it. I came away smiling. I thought it was well done. I thought it was heartrending. And I think I understood why you liked it so much, because they take a question that I know is the kind of question you and I love, which is, hey, what would happen if people actually dressed up like superheroes, right? Mm-hmm. What would happen if we just, you know, put on uniforms and started being superheroes without having superpowers, right? Could we Batman it up? And that's a question that any superhero comic reading fan has wondered about. But they didn't do it the way you might expect, right? I mean, they definitely did the well, it's not going to be as easy as it looks angle, which you expect coming. But then they took it in a direction that was not the like, hey, look, if people really put their nose to the grindstone, they can overcome. They showed that it's freaking hard and you're going to get your ass whooped. And in
kicked.
Fact, yeah, right. Exactly. And they show in the first YouTube video that propels him into becoming the superhero, how he really did get, he got whooped up on, but the fact that he was out there at all trying, and the fact that he at least gained the upper hand a little bit at times during the fight, was all people wanted to turn him into a hero.
Yeah. And, yeah, I thought that was kind of the coolest part initially, was like seeing him going through all the motions I don't want to spoil it, but the movie's been out for 3 weeks, so you haven't seen it, see it now. That he goes through the motions, and no matter what he does, he's just not really good at it. You don't ever get the impression he ever will be good at it. But what really got me was Chloe Moretz and her character Hit Girl, which is essentially kind of the diametric opposite of Kick-Ass's character. So instead of someone who wanted to be a superhero, it was something that she was just kind of raised into doing by Nicolas Cage's character, and she didn't really have a say on the matter. It was just like, that's how things are. This is what my, you know, this is what my dad's been training me for, and what I do. And she's really good at what she does, and she, you know, she goes through at least half the movie shooting and slicing and dicing. And what I didn't initially appreciate until I watched it a second time is, you know, how much of a comparison between those two characters, between Aaron Johnson and Chloe Moretz's character. On one hand, is someone who really has the heart but has absolutely no talent for it, and someone else who has the talent but, you know, just does it because that's what daddy wanted. And I thought it was heart-wrenching at the end, but at the same time, it was just really cool because, you know, you have essentially an 11-year-old girl going through and taking out a bunch of mobsters, which is, you know, fun.
Everything Hit Girl did was amazing. And what was cool about it is that the story is not predictable. I don't know that I ever rolled my eyes at it saying, you had to do this, you had to do that part. And Hit Girl is probably the most stereotypical of the bunch because she is able to do these things that you wouldn't expect her to do. And she's over the top and overtrained and everything. But because she's so small, such a little girl, everything she does is somewhat unpredictable and somewhat ridiculous to the point that you love it because it's unexpected.
It's absurd.
And the guy who plays Kick-Ass, it's the star of the show. She is definitely, Hit Girl is the star of the show.
She is probably the only one that's going to come out of this movie with a better career because of it. Having interviewed her, it's interesting. So I was asking her, like, the actress who played Hit Girl, how difficult it was to actually prepare for the role and do all that stuff. And it turns out that she is a trained gymnast, and she was studying ballet. So she was very physical from the get-go, and she has four older brothers, so she's used to roughhousing. She said she pretty much did almost every stunt in that movie herself, except the final part where she runs up the wall and does the somersault around. So I'm really impressed because that takes a lot of work and physicality. I mean, just being that physical, running through, because the suit's made out of leather, it's really hot. You got to run through, and you got to jump, and you got to essentially do all these moves, and more than likely you have to do multiple takes of it.
And you know what else impressed me is that I forgot that was Nicolas Cage. And that is more and more difficult every time I see a movie with Nicolas Cage, but he really became that role. And I don't want to do any spoilers, but his role in particular proved to me that this was not a fantasy telling. This was a more realistic telling of what would happen if people tried to become superheroes. And there's some fantasy elements of it. I'm not trying to say it's real, you know, really true to life. But his story in particular was one where you could pretty much believe it top to bottom.
Yeah, I mean, there are instances. I mean, I'm not sure if you're very familiar with this concept. It's called the RLSH, which is real life superheroes. These are people that actually do dress up and do stuff, but it's not in the same manner. They're more likely to volunteer, and it's more of a flashy way to do it. They'll do community outreach, you know, community.
They don't go beat up criminals, you're saying.
Mainly because one of the rules is, you know, don't get in a situation where you're going to get knifed or, you know, have your ass handed back to you. It's more of like a community watch, cleaning up, assisting with community programs and stuff like that. So it's not in the same way where, not even the same vein as, say, like the Guardian Angels. I'm not sure if
you're familiar. Yeah, that's what I was thinking of, is the Guardian Angels, because they have outfits with the beret yes. and everything, but they actually do protection, although they also have a code yeah. about not getting involved yeah. in violence, right?
They traditionally, they've changed, from what I understand, they've changed a little bit from being what they were back in the 70s to more of a presence. So they'll walk in pairs and there'll be an extra pair of eyes. So if something does go down, they will contact the police. Traditionally, they've, you know, back when they started, they've always had the police have always had a love-hate relationship with them, because it was, you know, yeah, there are people out there trying to do something for the community, but at the same time, they're like, you know, they're wannabe cops and they don't know anything and they get in trouble and then they're going to call us, kind of thing. But over the years, I think they've worked out a role where they help galvanize community responses to a number of things, not just crime, but also things like, you know, community outreach again and helping and doing other things like, you know, cleaning up potential hazards, not hazardous sites, but garbage, you know, needles and stuff like that. So, you know, I think there is a role for stuff like that, you know, not in the same way as the movie, but to have people, you know, physically out there and helping the community, although in some, you know, somewhat of a flamboyant way for certain individuals.
Seinfeld in the chat room wanted me to point out that it's heart-rending, not heart-wrenching, Roger.
Oh.
It's gut-wrenching, but heart-rending.
Did I say wrenching or rending?
I don't know. I didn't hear you say it, but he says you did, and he was very insistent that I pointed out.
I didn't. Did I? I didn't
say he gave me a lot of points for saying heart-rending instead of wrenching.
I didn't say either. Did I? I don't remember saying it. Maybe I said it. Yeah.
Well, just know that it is heart-rending.
Just know I'm being
it is heart-rending to Seinfeld when you say heart-wrenching.
I'm being admonished by the chat room. All right. That's fine.
Let's finish up with one comment. We got two comments on last week's episode, so we'll read one of them. Jeffrey Johnson says, I've been thinking about the idea of an alien race encountering us recently, and while I am not a scientist, it seems to me that if a race is advanced enough to get to the Earth, they have probably gotten past the problems that are the reasons that sci-fi stories have them try to subjugate us. Food, energy, resources. I know I'm projecting human traits and limitations, but seems like when we have the tech that will allow us interstellar travel, we will also have the tech for the singularity. Not that we will be nice to each other at that point, but it would not be worth the trouble of running to another planet to take their stuff.
Maybe. I mean, you're assuming that their technology would keep them, you know, physically active and alive for the entire trip, and they would have an active power source and a constant means of propulsion. They could very well be a race of like insectoids that literally lie dormant until they reach another planet that's habitable, and they reawaken and, you know, ravage the planet, then jump off again to somewhere else.
I think he's got a point, though, right? If you've gotten your society to the point where you can do interstellar travel, there's probably not much reason why you would exploit a lower civilization.
Unless you spend all your resources to get to interstellar travel and you need another planet to take advantage of.
Well, yeah, but I think you're right. I think resource extraction might be the one reason that you would, but you wouldn't go after humans like in V. You wouldn't go after them personally. It'd be like pests that you just need to kind of brush out of the way to get what you want. Same way that we treat animals now when we're going after resources. We don't go in and like infiltrate the monkey colonies
or the Avatar cells.
No, we just go in and we start mining, and the animals run away, and we'll go after elephants because we want their tusks. So maybe if the resource they needed was inside of us, then we'd have to worry. But there are probably human rights activists on all of those interstellar ships that would try to at least keep down the abuses, don't you think?
Maybe, probably not though. I mean, I don't know. It's really hard because alien species, because we actually have no evidence of any existing, we can only theorize. And a lot of how we theorize is we kind of take our model of civilization and we build upon that. It could very well be a hive mind where things like individuality, freedom, pain, suffering, stuff, you know, don't really register. It's just either move aside and let's get resources. If you get in the way, will destroy you kind of thing.
I think you're right. I think we would be mostly irrelevant as long as we didn't cause trouble or weren't the resource they were after. I don't think it would be personal.
Yeah, I really don't think if any future human alien contact, we're going to have this, you know, these grandiose debates between, you know, our very scholared politicians
take
as they sit around.
Leader.
Yeah, none of that crap. It's going to be, you're going to see a giant, you know, object land in a resource rich part of the planet and start mining or drilling or taking what they need. And, you know, they'll notice humans, and humans will maybe circle them around a few times. But, you know, they keep their distance. They continue mining. When they're done, they'll leave after they raped our planet dry.
Yeah, actually, this could explain UFOs a lot, right? Which is they go to out of the way places because they don't want to bother the native wildlife. They want to be away from it. And so, you know, and they occasionally abduct some samples to do some studies, but mostly they just stay away from those herds because it's too much trouble. So they're
if they wanted mineral resources, they're probably mining the asteroid belt than the planet.
There you go.
It'd be a lot easier to move those objects, I think.
Good thought-provoking post, though, Jeffrey Johnson. Thanks for that. You can make a post as well, thought-provoking or otherwise, at subbrilliant.com/EMW. That's our website. And you can watch us record this show live, as many people are doing right now, every Sunday on the Twit Network, live.twit.tv. Thanks to Leo Laporte for letting us do East Meets West on the network. And thanks to Jammerbee for producing it every week. Thank you, Roger, for co-hosting. Yep. and for carrying the torch last week. You'll be doing it again next week, actually. Do you know who you want to have on next week? Because I'm not going to be on a plane during normal East Meets West time.
I have no idea. I'll have to think of someone.
All right. So post some suggestions for Roger. And then I'm going to be doing the reverse the week after that. Roger's going to be out of town. So then I'll have to go it solo. But we also thank you for listening to us ramble on every week. I have to say, in the 5 years we've been doing this, I am quite surprised. Not only are we still doing it, but we're getting more and more people listening to it. It's just kind of crazy.
Yep. It's amazing. It's awesome.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Bye.